Okay, let's unpack this. Today, we're diving deep into one of life's greatest mysteries, how sunlight basically transforms into everything we eat and breathe.
Yeah, it's fundamental.
And our guide, the brilliant Dr. Hoffman. His lectures have given us some truly mind-bending insights into photosynthesis.
Absolutely.
Our mission here is to cut through the complexity, find those aha moments, and give you a shortcut to being, you know, really well informed about this incredible process.
Indeed. And what's fascinating, I think, is how Dr. Hoffman expands our view. It's not just plants. He frames photosynthesis with this rich ancient evolutionary history.
Right.
And these surprising ecological implications that, well, they underpin nearly all life.
And that's exactly where we should start. Because if you're like me, you hear photosynthesis, you picture a green leaf, right?
Pretty much the standard image, yeah.
But Dr. Hoffman points out this process has been around for billions of years.
Why?
Way longer than plants.
Billions with a B.
So if it's not just plants doing this heavy lifting, who else is involved in this ancient vital dance?
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Hoffman really emphasizes that. Photosynthesis is ancient. It actually predates eukaryotes, you know, cells, with a proper nucleus.
Whoa.
Yeah, by billions of years. Photosynthetic bacteria were the originals. They developed this at least 2 billion years ago.
That's a billion.
Wild plants. They've only been on the scene for about 500 million years. And even today, algae, a huge diverse group, they're major photosynthesizers, especially in the oceans. And they're also much older than land plants.
So this isn't just a leaf thing. It's global. It's ancient. A planetary energy capture system.
Exactly.
And Dr. Hoffman calls these organisms producers. What exactly does that mean, being a producer, and why is that so critical for the rest of us, the consumers?
Precisely. Producers, in Dr. Hoffman's definition, are organisms making their own food, mostly via photosynthesis.
Okay.
Though he does mention chemosynthetic organisms, too, making food from chemicals, not light. Kind of an interesting side note.
Right.
But for consumers, like us, it means we absolutely depend on producers for those organic molecules, the building blocks, the energy we need, period. It's the foundation.
It's the base of almost all food chains. Without producers, there's no food for anyone else, really.
Astonishingly fundamental. Okay, so let's loop back to what is familiar. Dr. Hoffman does bring us back to plants, specifically leaves. He describes them as perfectly engineered. What makes a leaf such a specialized organ?
Well, leaves are typically the greenest part for a reason. They are specialized photosynthesis factories. Dr. Hoffman uses this great visual, a sandwich arrangement.
A sandwich?
Yeah, with waxy epidermal layers top and bottom, like waterproofing.
Keeps the water in. Makes sense.
But, and here's the clever bit, it can't be totally waterproof. They need to swap gases.
Ah, right. CO2 and oxygen.
Exactly. That's where stomata come in, tiny pores. Gateways for CO2 in, O2 out. And inside that sandwich, the main action happens in the middle layer, the mesophyll.
And inside those mesophyll cells, Dr. Hoffman introduces the real workhorses. Chloroplasts. Right. He mentions, what, like 50 per cell?
Yeah, typically around 50, really gives you that factory image, doesn't it? It does. So how do these tiny factories, the chloroplasts, organize themselves?
So chloroplasts are the dedicated organelles for this in eukaryotes. Like mitochondria are for respiration.
Okay, got it.
Dr. Hoffman highlights their double membrane, outer and inner, but the inner membrane does something ingenious. It folds inward extensively, forming the thylakoid membrane.
More folding, like mitochondria again.
Exactly. That thylakoid membrane makes these coin-like sacs, thylakoids, often stacked into grana. It's all about massively increasing the surface area for the reactions.
Efficiency.
Totally. Mm. And you have distinct compartments, the inner membrane space, the stroma, that's the fluid inside the inner membrane, but outside the thylakoids and the thylakoid space, inside the thylakoids themselves, very organized.
And he mentioned, be careful not to mix up scoma, the pore, with stroma, the fluid.
Good point. Yes, he specifically cautions against that. Easy mistake to make.
Okay. Dr. Hoffman also gives the overall summary reaction. What's the key takeaway there? And how does it mirror cellular respiration?
The simplified summary is just beautifully elegant. 6 CO2 plus 6 H2O yields glucose, C6H12O6 plus 6 O2.
Carbon dioxide, water, makes sugar and oxygen.
Pretty much. And Dr. Hoffman really stresses the reciprocal relationship with respiration. The inputs of one are the outputs of the other and vice versa.
A neat cycle.
But here's where it gets really interesting. A common misconception gets busted.
Oh, go on.
You'd probably assume the oxygen plants release comes from the CO2 they take in, right?
6 to 2 cents, yeah.
But Dr. Hoffman explicitly says, nope, That's not what happens. The oxygen byproduct comes entirely.
Entirely.
Entirely from the water molecule, H2O.
Wow. Okay, that is an aha moment. Oxygen from water.
It creates this perfect reversal with respiration where oxygen ends up accepting hydrogens to form water. It's just neat.
So how does Dr. Hoffman break down this whole complex process inside the chloroplast factory? Make it manageable.
He divides it into two Meiji phases, both inside the chloroplast. First, the light-dependent reactions.
Dependent on light, obviously.
Obviously. These are, as he puts it, anabolic building bigger things and endergonic. They need energy input, which of course is sunlight.
Okay.
Inputs are light and water. Output is oxygen as a byproduct. But crucially, they also generate two high-energy molecules, ATP and NADPH.
The energy currency.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Dr. Hoffman uses this great analogy. Organisms can't just use raw sunlight to build stuff, just like we can't use the energy in a whole pizza directly.
Or you need a process.
It needs to be packaged into usable currency, like ATP and NADPH. Think of it as a specialized energy taxi or delivery truck carrying high energy electrons specifically for photosynthesis.
Okay, so the plant makes these little energy packets first.
Wow.
How is that light energy actually captured without just, you know, dissipating his heat? How do these photosystems work?
Yeah, it's not just absorbing light, it's trapping it. Imagine a microscopic funnel. A photosystem is a big protein complex in the thylakoid membrane.
Okay.
Packed with pigments, chlorophyll A, B, carotenoids in these light harvesting complexes. They absorb photons, the light particles.
Like antennas.
Sort of. When a photon hits a pigment, the energy bounces around pigment to pigment like a wave.
Okay.
Until it reaches a special pair of chlorophyll A molecules in the reaction center. This excites them so much an electron actually gets kicked out of the chlorophyll, oxidizes it.
Loses an electron.
Right. And that high energy electron is immediately grabbed by a primary electron acceptor, reducing it. That's the key step. Light energy becomes chemical energy.
The energy of light is now stored in a reduced chemical. Got it.
Okay.
And Dr. Hoffman says there are two types, photosystem 2 and photosystem 1.
Correct.
And confusingly, photosystem 2 comes first.
Yeah, just named in order of discovery, not operation. Classic science. But yes, photosystem 2 acts first.
Okay. And how are they linked?
They're linked functionally and structurally by an electron transport chain. Again, very similar to respiration.
Right. Pumping protons.
You got it. The main goal is pumping hydrogen ions, protons, across that thylakoid membrane, build up a concentration gradient.
And that gradient drives
ATP synthase, the enzyme that makes ATP, process called chemiosmosis. Same basic principle.
So it's charging up those ATP batteries. Okay, walk us through that electron flow again. Where do they come from initially? Where do they end up?
Right. In the main pathway, non-cyclic flow. Photosystem 2 grabs light, loses an electron. That electron has to be replaced.
Yeah, and it comes from?
Splitting water. That's the second big aha. Water splitting provides the electron for photosystem 2.
Which is why water is essential.
Absolutely. And it's where the oxygen comes from, what's left after you strip electrons and protons from water.
Okay, so electron from water goes to PSII.
Then it travels down the first electron transport chain, driving ATP synthesis.
Mm.
Then it replaces an electron lost by photosystem I, which has also absorbed light.
Okay, PSI gets its electron replaced.
Then the electron from photosystem ICO goes down a second, shorter electron transport chain. This one doesn't pump protons. Its job is to reduce NADP plus into NADPH.
The energy taxi gets loaded.
Exactly. So the net result of non-cyclic flow, both ATP and NADPH are produced.
Okay, that electron journey makes sense now. But Dr. Hoffman points out a ratio problem. The next stage, the Calvin cycle, needs a 3.2 ratio of ATP to NADPH.
That's right.
But this non-cyclic flow makes them roughly 1-to-1.
So how does the plant fix that imbalance?
This really highlights the plant's adaptability.
Mm.
Because you're right. If it just ran non-cyclic, it would run out of ATP or have way too much NADPH.
Wouldn't be efficient.
Not at all. So Dr. Hoffman explains the plant's clever trick.
Mm-hmm.
It can switch to cyclic electron transport.
Cyclic. How does that work?
In this mode, the electron-leaving photosystem Ibaraga gets recycled. Instead of going to make NADPH, it's fed back into the main electron transport chain between PSII and PSI.
Loops back.
It loops back. And this loop only pumps protons, therefore it only makes ATP. No NADPH is produced in cyclic flow.
So it can top up the ATP levels.
Precisely. It allows the plant to fine-tune the ATP-NADPH ratio to exactly match the Calvin cycle's demands. It's like it senses when the NADPH taxis are full.
When all the NADP plus is reduced to NADPH, and it switches to cyclic mode just to make the extra ATP needed.
Wow. So it's constantly adjusting its internal power grid. That's That's remarkably smart.
It really is. Incredible biochemical sophistication at work.
Okay, so now our plant has the energy carriers ATP and NADPH in the right ratio. Dr. Huffman takes us to the light-independent reactions, the Calvin cycle. This is where the actual carbon fixation happens, taking CO2 from the air and making
it. Yeah, exactly. This happens in the stroma, that fluid space. The goal, take inorganic CO2 and build organic compounds, sugars, basically.
And this is the bit we consumers absolutely cannot do.
Right. Dr. Huffman stresses this is the key differentiator. Mm-hmm. We can't fix carbon. Producers can. The cycle has three main phases.
And central to that first phase, carbon fixation, is an enzyme Dr. Huffman calls probably the most plentiful enzyme on Earth. What is it?
That would be the legendary Rubisco.
Rubisco.
Okay, short for ribulose bisphosphate carboxylase oxygenase.
Right.
Quite a mouthful. In phase one, CO2 combines with the 5-carbon sugar, RuBP. Rubisco helps make an unstable 6-carbon molecule that immediately splits into 2 identical 3-carbon molecules. That's carbon fixation. Gas becomes solid, essentially.
Dr. Huffman reveals a big problem with Rubisco, a surprising inefficiency.
Yes. This is such a fascinating point. Rubisco has carboxylase in its name, good, grab CO2. But it also has oxygenase.
Oxygenase, meaning it grabs oxygen.
Unfortunately, yes. It can bind to oxygen instead of CO2, especially when O2 levels are high or CO2 is low. And oxygen actually has a higher affinity for it, which is, well, awkward.
So what happens then?
When it grabs oxygen, no carbon gets fixed, no sugar progress. And worse, it actually costs the plant ATP to undo the mistake. This whole wasteful detour is called photorespiration.
Photorespiration. So the most abundant enzyme has a major flaw.
It's kind of mind-boggling, isn't it? Most plants just live with it, deal with this inefficiency.
Wow. Okay, so assuming Rubisco does grab CO2 successfully, what happens after fixation?
Right. Assuming it works properly, we enter the reduction phase. This is where the ATP and NADPH from the light reactions get used.
Then the energy to work.
Exactly. They convert those 3-carbon compounds into a different 3-carbon molecule called glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate, or G3P.
G3P.
And Dr. Huffman notes this G3P is the direct output of the cycle. We often say photosynthesis makes glucose, but G3P comes first.
So G3P is the building block.
It is. Plants can stick 2 G3Ps together to make glucose or use G3P to build amino acids, fats, everything else. Then the final phase is regenerating that starting molecule, RoBP, which needs more ATP so the cycle can go again.
And it's called light independent, but it relies totally on the light reactions products, right?
Absolutely. It'll run for a bit in the dark using leftover ATP and NADPH, but then it grinds to a halt. It's indirectly dependent on light.
Okay, so plants churn out G3P. Now back to that Rubisco flaw, photorespiration. Dr. Huffman explains evolution found workarounds in some plants.
It did. Some really clever strategies to beat the system. Most plants, called C3 plants, just suffer through photorespiration.
The standard model.
Right. But then you have C4 plants, like corn, sugarcane. They use spatial separation.
Spatial separation.
They have 2 cell types involved. Mesophyll cells near the surface and deeper bundle sheath cells. In the mesophyll, they use a different enzyme, PEP carboxylase, which only grabs CO2, ignores oxygen completely.
Smart.
Very. It fixes CO2 into an organic acid, which is then shuttled to the deeper bundle sheath cells. There, the CO2 is released, creating a high CO2 concentration right where Rubisco and the Calvin cycle are waiting, effectively swamping out the oxygen.
So they concentrate the CO2 for Rubisco.
Clever.
What's the other strategy?
That's CAM plants, crassulation acid metabolism. Think cacti, succulents plants in hot, dry places.
Desert plants.
Yep. They use temporal separation, time-based. During the day, it's hot and dry, so they keep their stomata closed tight to save water.
But then they can't get CO2.
Exactly. So they open their stomata at night when it's cooler and less water evaporates. They take in CO2 then, fix it into organic acids, and store it overnight.
Banking the CO2.
Pretty much. Then, during the day, with the stomata closed, they release that stored CO2 internally, feeding it to the Calvin cycle while the sun provides the ATP and NADPH. Again, concentrating CO2 around Rubisco, but separated by time instead of space.
Wow. Two completely different solutions to the same Rubisco oxygen problem.
Mm-hmm.
Evolution is amazing.
Isn't it? It just shows how significant that photorespiration inefficiency really is.
So here's where it gets really interesting. Dr. Huffman's deep dive shows us photosynthesis isn't just chemistry. It's this incredible evolutionary journey, this amazing cellular architecture that makes life as we know it possible. From ancient bacteria changing the planet's atmosphere to these highly specialized desert plants, It's all about harnessing sunlight.
It really is. And it brings up this important question. When Dr. Hoffman points out that the direct output is G3P, that three carbon sugar, and that plants often convert this into sucrose, table sugar, basically, to transport energy to parts that don't photosynthesize, like roots or fruits. What does that tell you?
What does it tell us?
Well, think about the fundamental interconnectedness. The energy flow, even within just one plant. How much of that plant that we might eat, the fruit, the root, the stem, relies entirely on this unseen internal transport of sugars made somewhere else in the leaf using energy captured from sunlight.
It really does make you think about every piece of plant-based food differently, doesn't it? That apple, that potato, it's all stored sunlight moved around by the plant itself.
Precisely. A hidden network powered by photosynthesis.
Absolutely fascinating. Well, thank you for taking this deep dive with us. We hope you're feeling a little more well-informed and maybe a lot more curious about the green world all around us.
Hope so.
Until next time, keep exploring.